Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's Stu Webb here at StuWebb.com, and it is November the 2nd, Wednesday, 2022. And I have the honor to have a special guest on today, Paul Register. Now, he's going to explain his story. It's to deal with basically child protective services and other things in Redfield, South Dakota. He's already been on the news there, local news, TV, etc. I'll be posting the videos, etc., of the interviews that he did with the TV stations, along with this broadcast here this morning. But I'm going to take Paul. I welcome you, Paul, and I just want you to take and tell your story.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Stu. I really appreciate it. And basically, the whole thing started for me back in January of 2016. The previous 6 months, I had come into contact with a few things. I was working for the South Dakota Developmental Center in Redfield, and we had an interesting situation where in May or June of 2015, things seemed to be going relatively smooth there, and then all of a sudden there was a group of 30 legislators that met at the auditorium at the Developmental Center. And it was a two-day closed-door meeting. They never went and visited with the staff. You saw some of them walking through the campus and kind of surveying stuff. And then on the heels of that, suddenly it was as though they flipped the switch and we started having all these hiring issues where suddenly we went from a staff where we were 12 positions short to suddenly in just 10 months time, we went to 49 positions short. And so a group of us kind of got together and we're trying to decipher what to do. And in the meantime, we had several occurrences take place that they weren't offering any kind of staff protections on. In the program area where I worked, if I just included the daytime and evening staff, not including the overnights because they wouldn't be the ones really dealing much with behaviors. Out of 55 staff, we had 5 concussions in a 2 month time span. Now, we did have 3 different program areas out there at the time, and I'll make mention of what took place at one of the other ones, but this also occurred around the same time where I had a coworker come to my office on one occasion where me and my office mate, we were sitting there, and this gentleman asks us, can we have a counselor meeting? And me and this other counselor were like, sure, what's going on? And he shows us this email of how one of our behavior therapists had given one of our most dangerous residents a pocket knife, and he was roaming around campus. This gentleman was probably in his early 20s, to give you an idea of why I say he was dangerous. When he was 14 years old, he was left alone on a holiday on the dorm with a 60-year-old woman. And the remainder of the group went over to the schooling area where they were going to have activities throughout the day, but he refused to transport. And one later on in the morning, he comes out of his room, approaches a 60-year-old woman, and she doesn't think anything of it. And next thing you know, he wraps a Nintendo cord around her neck, pulls her to the ground. Her handheld radio skips away. He grabs it and starts beating her over the head with it, all with the expressed intent of raping her. And so, thankfully, she managed to crawl to a central area, and they got help. And eventually, this kid was sent out of state to receive intense sexual treatment therapy, and eventually came back years later. But he was the one that this behavior therapist had given a pocket knife to and was roaming the campus with. And so we had to devise a plan to get this pocket knife back. And so thankfully, my office mate and I we had a good rapport with this kid because we were actually his dorm staff almost a decade before, or it would have been a decade before. And so we invited him over to our office, and we had three staff in the office next door to us, and they were there to be there as backup. We had the door shut, but had the door closed just in case things got squirrely and got out of hand, because all we were doing was trying to make an exchange, the pocket knife for a convenience store gift card. And thankfully the kid took the offer without hesitation, handed over the pocket knife, and things were dealt with. But
now, this was real quick. Now, this is to deal with basically a health center that you worked in, and this was state controlled, South Dakota, and this is ties to child protective services, et cetera, in mental cases, basically. Is that true?
This is for the developmentally disabled, but one of the things that is really interesting about it is that the majority of our clientele in my program area, it was an alarming amount of Native American kids that were coming here, and the reason that these kids were being brought there is because, lack of a better way of putting it, South Dakota is trafficking Native American kids for the federal benefits. In a report that was done by a lawyer with the Lakota Law Project by the name of Daniel Sheen, who posted a YouTube video that explains the entire scenario very well and how this was all once set up, where an algorithm was created out of Texas under the watchful eye of George W. Bush, as you can imagine. And so then he contacts his longtime friend, who was our governor at the time, Bill Janklow, and he tells, according to what Mr. Sheehan said, he's like, you've got a bonanza of Native American kids up there. And so in 2001, suddenly you saw all these kids being pulled from their homes, and they will be put in the foster care program. They will be put into placements all across South Dakota. And so it was to the tune of, like, for every kid, they received $79,000 of benefit per kid in 2001. And according to the report, if I remember the number correctly, it was 741 kids the first year, which basically adds up to $58 million that goes into our Department of Social Services budget. So they wanted to make certain that this cash cow was being, that nothing would happen to it. And so that ultimately, what there went on from there is that they went ahead and protected the woman who gave the kid the pocket knife, and so it kind of led me down a course where it's like, what is actually going on? Because it's like, I was in the office with the head of personnel for South Dakota. He saw the email, and his own words were, that's a terminating offense. But she remained there for two more years without any kind of, like, real punishment for giving this kid the pocket knife. And it wasn't that long ago that this same kid made a similar attack to the one that he did the 60-year-old, only like 2-3 years ago. And he was actually incarcerated for a brief time after this. And the crazy part was that the next time I saw the kid, I was in Pierre, South Dakota, and I walk into a gas station, and I see him there, and just struck up a conversation, and he explains to me what he was incarcerated for, and that he is now not under any supervision other than his mother, and he is walking the streets of Pierre, South Dakota, and had a job at a gas station, and it's like, whoever knows your track record, how on earth do you gain any form of employment? after these series of sexual assaults. And so, but...
Now, I would ask you a question.
Yes.
There's Indian reservations in South Dakota, North Dakota, but were these kids targeted by the government of South Dakota?
Yeah. I mean, it's very much where they've been doing it for the better part of 20 some odd years, and so these kids they are able to they seek out like exploitable situations where basically like single parents and certainly any opportunity that they can pull these Native American kids from their homes, they're going to do it.
Okay, now is this the federal government doing or the state of South Dakota?
This is the state of South Dakota.
Okay, one of the reasons I ask is because I'm aware, if you remember the movie Billy Jack, okay, it was back in the 70s. Well, I was locked up as a political prisoner in Denver, and they were transferring Leonard Peltier, that they made a movie about, Billy Jack. They transferred him through the detention center there in Littleton, Colorado, where I was being held. And so I got a meeting. Well, I had 007 Otis Johnson was in there. The guy that busted John Gotti was in there, both under protective custody. And they suggested I go talk to him because they were transferring him to Supermax down in Pueblo, Colorado. It's underground about 3 floors. And so I had the opportunity to get his whole story, which is basically what Otis told me. And I won't mention the guy's name, busted John Gotti, but he was a former CIA New York cop. And I had opportunity to meet Peltier, as I said, and talk with him. And it turned out to be what it was, is the Daddy Bush was stealing the oil off the Indian reservation, which the oil is part of these Indian reservations. It's the money's divided up among the Indians who were part of that reservation.
Absolutely.
Well, Daddy Bush was stealing about 90% of the oil, and they had FBI agents that would go out and read the meters on the Indian reservation, because this is part of what their job was. Well, it turns out to be that Peltier and one of the other guys that were on the Indian reservation, Billy Jack as the movie called him, they accused him of killing 2 FBI agents. And what it was, he found out and discovered, Peltier did, and he's innocent as can be, still in prison for life. Ramsey Clark, the former attorney general out in New York, is representing him, trying to get him out of jail. I had a big story written in a Las Vegas paper about him by Colleen Lloyd, who was a reporter there. And here was the point. They were turning back the 2 federal agents to go out, and they would turn back the meter to make it look like they weren't pulling any oil out of the ground. Okay, so when Peltier found out what they were actually doing, him and his buddy, they went to another jurisdiction in their state. I forgot which state it was, North Dakota, South Dakota, wherever the Indian reservation was. So they go to another jurisdiction, another FBI office, and they tell them what's going on. So that office sent out 2 completely different, clean, good guys to the Indian reservation on the day that the FBI was to show up and read the meter. And they kept the 2 good guys, catch the 2 bad guys, FBI bad guys, turning the meter back. So they went to arrest them, and they shot and killed them. The 2 bad guys shot the 2 good guys, and they blamed Leonard Peltier. I just thought I'd bring that to everybody's attention.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, like, the name Peltier didn't mean anything to me when I first arrived in South Dakota. Actually, the first time I ever really came into contact with, I was a corrections officer at 1.5 years, and one of Peltier's descendants was one of the ones on my cell hall, and so he actually made mention of who he was. Looking back now, I'm a little embarrassed, but having grown up on the West Coast, obviously it's not something that you come into contact near as much. But yeah, so with all the stuff that is basically going on, all this money is designed to come in from the federal dollars, and then it goes into the Department of Social Services budget for South Dakota. And here's where things get really interesting, is that in South Dakota, nonprofits are self-policing. So all this countless cash for not just for these children, but for any kind of federal funding, it can get pushed into a nonprofit. And with South Dakota, there are 10,000 nonprofits for 800,000 citizens. So for one in nonprofit for every 80 citizens. And so all this money can get pushed into where they need it to. And so often that money going undetected and it ends up in the wrong people's hands who are buying up a lot of real estate in South Dakota, who are in the trucking industry, because a lot of times the trucking industry are the ones who are assisting with the trafficking. And so it ends up in the hands. And so that is essentially how the circle works, is that all this money ends up in the hands where the trafficking takes place, and it is designed to help finance South Dakota's opioid crisis. Because if you were to look at the ballot right now, one of the things that I know a lot of South Dakotans are up in arms about is that twice in the last 6 years, we've had the public vote completely repealed on two occasions. The first one was when it was initiated Measure 22 in 2016, where it basically was a measure that a lot of South Dakotans interpreted that we would get like an independent audit to come in for South Dakota for that to take place. So people wanted to see this state looked into, and it passed by a very slim margin. And all of a sudden you saw a couple of state officials resign almost instantaneously, and then they got together and a group of legislators got together and created a lawsuit to get the public vote repealed, which Attorney General at the time, Marty Jackley, is the one who granted the repeal. And in 2020, the public voted to legalize marijuana. And with a lot of the situations right now is that they went and basically shut down the public vote and didn't grant the legalization. There actually is an item on the ballot this time that is addressing that. What most South Dakotans don't realize is that marijuana is the direct competition to how South Dakota is making its money. They are basically creating their own opioid crisis, and then it's basically all that is financed on the back of them taking the Native American children. And so with all the money that is being generated, they're doing everything they can to offset the marijuana vote as it stands right now.
So they did the legislation in South Dakota. Basically what you're saying is most of them are probably corrupt.
Oh, absolutely. It's, I mean, it's not to speak poorly about one party over another, but any party that has remained that has held on to the crown for 40 years, which I mean, like, basically that they know they can push anything through around here. And so it's not just the legislators, it's basically you have to get sheriffs in place to be able to get all this accomplished with the drug culture. And with I've had repeated reports where basically they will arrest somebody on a meth charge, and within days that person is back on the street for a couple of reasons. One is that they specifically asked the person who they incarcerated, and I've heard this on a few different occasions, to like out somebody else in the community so that they know who else is susceptible. The other thing that they do is they ask them to do controlled buys so that they can, like, have somebody go in and purchase. And anytime that they have somebody do the controlled buy, obviously they have them locked down for the rest of the time, or for all time, because it's like, well, you went and did this purchase. And so when they have these people pointing the finger at all the other people that are on meth, one of the other things that ultimately it does is that it gets these people out of prison so that they don't lose their customers.
Interesting. So you believe that most of the sheriffs are corrupt in South Dakota?
Oh, absolutely. I've been doing a bit of research into one of the things that stands out to me, and it stood out to me ever since 2004, was these people that fall under the categories of missing, murdered, wrongful death, or what I call South Dakota suicides. And the first occurrence, it was one that we spoke about, was in 2004. I was a non-trad student, and I was going to class at Northern State University, and I'm walking across campus, passing by the library, and all of a sudden I see police tape, and it's like, what do we have going on here? And as the story began to come out, it was the story of a professor by the name of Morgan Lewis, and he taught German at Northern State University. And at 6:30 in the morning, he walked off the campus and supposedly shot himself in the back of the neck, and the gun was found in the dumpster 30 yards away. Initially, while it was declared a homicide, a year later, they converted it to a suicide. And the other thing that was really pertinent about that was that he shot himself on the opposite side of the neck of his dominant hand. And so that was kind of my aha moment. But the other thing that stood out to me was how little the citizens of South Dakota they just kind of went on with life. And it was like, my goodness, it's like, don't you guys want answers? And then 2000, when Marty Jackley, he was the attorney general, and he's the only one on the ballot this time to retake the attorney general spot. We had in 2013, 2015, were some of the biggest scandals that ever hit South Dakota. They were tied in with the Gear Up program, and it's what's known as the Gear Up scandal. And the business manager for Gear Up, the state claims that he learned that their financing was going to be cut off, so he went home that night and shot his wife and four kids, and then set fire to his house and then turned the gun on himself. So you had a family of six in a town of 1,200 people just slaughtered. And so, and then the other one that really stood out, and this falls into the whole South Dakota suicide, was a gentleman involved with the EB-5 program, and when his name was Richard Benda, and he went out to a remote location outside of Lake Andes, South Dakota, went out to a farmhouse and had a hunting vest on and shot himself in the stomach and propped the gun up against the tree, and yet they went ahead and declared that one a suicide. And so as time went on, you start to see these different circumstances of the missing, murdered, wrongful death, or the South Dakota suicides. They just kept popping up, and not all of them were murders. It was suddenly a lot of missing people that they simply can't get answers for. In my 20-some-odd years of living in South Dakota, I don't recall seeing any murder get solved. You hear reports of them, and you see the reports, but nothing ever gets solved here. And it's like, and a woman earlier this year, and people can go online and find this book, it's a book called Someone Knows, or Somebody Knows, and it's written by a woman by the name of Chris Mager Webbick. And in this book is a listing of 55 of these cases, where it's all these circumstances of these people missing, murdered, whatnot. And then at the end of it's all the local reports that have gone into each one of these cases, and they're all still wide open. And in many of these cases, at the tail end of the stories, they have written letters to the missing or deceased by their loved ones or family or friends or family members. And so that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. I know that I believe she herself said that there was 100 or so more, and very much with along the lines is just the fact you start to talk to these families, and they'll be the first ones to tell you our law enforcement is not trying to help this. Recently there was a report of a gentleman in his 30s who 2 years ago was walking along a road in southern South Dakota, and he was found 10 miles away from where his car was, and yet that family has been after answers for 2 years, and they're like, no, we know that that law enforcement isn't trying to help us. In fact, the Department of Criminal Investigation for South Dakota is actually trying to prevent it a lot of times.
I'll tell you a quick story. The super spooked 007 Otis Johnson, my friend that they murdered, he was working for General Flynn at the time. And 2 weeks later, after he was murdered with Stonar Technologies satellite, he got him a heart attack. On his deathbed, he told me. And General Flynn was fired 2 weeks later illegally, national security, for President Trump. But Otis was the direct assistant to William Casey when he was CIA director. And Casey, after he resigned, CIA director, he decided to go public, and there was a hearing set for him to testify that Daddy Bush was out of control, George Herbert Walker Bush, robbing, looting the country, drugging the country, selling weapons, doing all this stuff. Debbie Davis, I've had her on here, and John McCain was one of his stooges, trafficking the kids down in Arizona and the whole bit, human trafficking as well, body parts, and he was head of Armed Services Committee. But here's the story. Otis told me that William Casey, when he was to go testify, Daddy Bush went to his office, had two goons hold him down in his chair the morning he was going to testify, took a needle, shoved it in his temple, caused him a cerebral hemorrhage. He laid in Bethesda Hospital, Naval Hospital. They had the floor shut off below him and above him for security reasons. Otis Johnson was allowed in there to see him, and so was his other direct assistant, top chiefs at the CIA. And he said that Casey told him what had happened, how Bush held him down, shoved the needle in his head, and he was still able to speak and remember things. And he was talking to the nurses and doctors. He laid there for 10 or 14 days before he finally died. And within 6 months, all the doctors and all the nurses who had been there and worked on him, they all ended up either car crash rollovers, like I've been in, where they were trying to murder me, and or they shot themselves either in the back of the head or took two bullets, one in the back of the head. And, oh, that didn't kill me, so I'm going to shoot myself in the mouth. Every one of the doctors and nurses were dead within 6 months. So this is the kind of stuff that goes on within our government, folks. It's that serious.
Yeah, absolutely.
But go ahead.
Yeah, and so basically the way that the state kind of gets this done is through their hiring practices with not just different positions within the legislature, but we're talking through law enforcement, through local educators. They basically make certain that their educators are ones that that they're looking for yes people when they're hiring, and they will specifically go find somebody who doesn't have the qualifications and give them the job, specifically with the intent purpose of giving them a position that they never could attain on their own, so they never want to relinquish it, and so they'll basically be a yes person till the end of time just because they want to maintain that position. And in and amongst the other circumstances I've seen in my town specifically, we had a circumstance where a local deputy was rumored to be having an affair with a woman here in town. And they go, and the gentleman finds out that his wife is with this deputy. It creates a lockdown situation at our local hospital. And he basically, like, it's my understanding, he kidnaps his own son in the hospital, and everything was resolved at that point peacefully. And the kid, and he went to prison for, I believe, 10 years. But the kicker was the deputy. He goes before the county commissioners, and they pretty much at that time ask for his resignation. So you think this guy's career in law enforcement is pretty much done in South Dakota, at least for a fair amount of time. He would have to go pursue other situations. And the ironic part was the next time I heard that gentleman's name, he was actually appointed sheriff of the next town over, after being the guy that created this hostage situation in a hospital. So, but yeah, so it's through these hiring practices. And when I look at the, like, there's a gentleman who was one of the, they put three people on trial in the Gear Up scandal. And of those three, each one of them got basically a slap on the wrist, and I was told in advance that that one of the defendants, like in the months leading up to her trial, her way of life never suffered. She never acted like she was concerned that she was going to go to jail. Her trial was the most linear that I've ever heard of. It was started on a Monday morning and ended on a Friday afternoon. The prosecutor was Marty Jackley once again, and so. Basically, that trial went off without a hitch. She was found not guilty, and then her cohort, he now is the administrator of a nursing home in South Dakota. So he moves on to a different position, and that nothing ever befalls them. I've been in numerous situations where I have the court documents of specific cases. And the circumstances that it's evident what has been going on is that these two cases are both murder cases, that you have the prosecutor and the defense working with the judge who's been assigned to the case, and they know the outcome before it ever happens. And I believe that this, if my estimation is correct, this has been going on for probably over 30 years now.
What can people do to change it, Paul?
Basically, what I'm trying to get done is I've been working with a lot of these families who are in and amongst the missing, murdered, and wrongful death, and I'm doing everything I can just to get one of these stories into the national spotlight, because if I am able to get one, I know I have the evidence to begin pulling the rest. And basically, like I said, it's like I have in one particular case, I have a specific situation where the gentleman that they incarcerated, he was, and this is their own documentation, he was 30 miles away on surveillance the entire time that he was supposedly committing his offenses. And so it's like, this is your own documentation that says he was there. And he was a gentleman who didn't speak very much English. He was never afforded an interpreter, let alone an attorney. And the agents who met with him, there were three of them, according to their report, basically saying, we felt we spoke well enough to be able to get the interview. And it's like, he wasn't protected one bit. And then later on, he's 30 miles away from the crime scene when it happens. And you guys are the ones putting out the evidence.
Okay. How bad is it when it comes to these congressmen and senators on the federal level as well as the state level? Are they all corrupt in your opinion in South Dakota?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And because for the longest time, you make mention of John McCain, John Thune, South Dakota, he was John McCain's go-to.
Yeah.
And so, and basically when it comes to like I've made mention of, like Mike Rounds' name was all over that EB-5 scandal. And then after that, he pretty much, Mike Rounds was the one who handpicked Marty Jackley to be the Attorney General. And Marty Jackley has been involved in plenty of nefarious scandals in South Dakota. If one thing that I can say is that from the moment he ran against Christine Noem for governor and lost, at least the scandals have fallen off a bit ever since Marty Jackley come out. Now the struggle is that he's the only one listed on the ballot for Attorney General this year, so he's looking to come back. And it's like, if he comes back, South Dakota will return to its slaughterhouse fashion.
Pretty sick.
Yeah.
Pretty sick. I've seen it so much, the corruption in other states that I've lived in.
And sadly, I was blissfully naive for roughly about 15 years, and it wasn't through this process that I suddenly jumped into a swamp that I didn't even know how bad it was. And so it started with me when in 2016, about a month after I left the developmental center, suddenly people throughout the state started reaching out to me, and one of which was brought my attention to a case where the state inadvertently managed to mismedicate a 17-year-old at a state-run facility in Custer, South Dakota, that has now been, I'll use the term torpedoed, because they had the intention of taking it off the books. And so, but this kid was on medications for acne, and he had previous reactions to doxycycline, but they put him on a derivative called minocycline. And over the course of weeks, it slowly deteriorated him, and ultimately in 2013, it killed him. And so, but once again, the state's accounts of the situation, they sweep that under the rug. The general practitioner who went to bat for this kid to try, they had a press conference in front of Christy Noem's office in Sioux Falls when she was in Washington, D.C. The local affiliates met there. They had the press conference. His mother was there. His general practitioner was there. And so they were hoping to get Christy Noem's help at that point, and she has shut them out the entire time. She claims to get to the bottom of it, and then when she was put into office, then it's been a complete shutout. And so, but the other interesting part of that is that that press conference never took place in South Dakota. They were there, but it was never aired on any of the affiliates. The other occurrence that I know of that happening was when a woman who helped bring to light that it's what is referred to as the Medi rape case out of Aberdeen, where a 6'9" foster father was sexually abusing his foster children for the better part of a decade. And when the state found out, he was hit with 24 charges. His wife had 3 or 4 charges against her, and it looked like the guy was going away to prison for the rest of his life. Suddenly, Marty Jackley intervenes. 23 of the 24 counts are completely wiped off the books. His wife is absolved of every count against her. And this gentleman basically gets a 15-year prison stint, and his wife has nothing against her, and the state takes the Native American kids and puts them back home with the wife.
No.
Yeah, and the woman who attempted to expose that, she had a press conference. She had it on YouTube. They showed it around. All the affiliates were there, and she highlighted who each one of them was with. And once again, that press conference never aired in South Dakota. And eventually, obviously, the YouTube link was shut down too.
So this is super rampant in South Dakota
having come from another state, and that's the really interesting part, is that I don't think a lot of South Dakotans can wrap their head around just how evil their state is. When you walk in here, your eyes are bugging out of your head, because it's like, how is this not looked into? How is this not looked into? You come from other places where it would never even come close to getting anywhere near this far. But South Dakota, you never hear anything on a national level about South Dakota. They have the capability to shut down everything because of all the money that they've been making off the backs of these Native American kids. They pretty much have a vast majority of the state on the payroll.
I know the Colorado is rampant. Child Protective Services.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because my ex-wife tried to murder our daughter when she was 28 days old. She agreed when the police came to keep from putting her in prison. She agreed to undergo a psychiatric evaluation with the state of Texas within 7 days. She'd been to 3 shrinks with me. I took her to 3 shrinks. She'd been married now, I think, 6 times, and each husband reported to me, or the first one and the third, I was number 2 and number 4, that they had taken her to shrinks and perfect little woman for the first 3 years, and all of a sudden the child abuse, now adult syndrome, comes out in her. Satanic abuse as well. But when the state of Texas notified the state of Colorado, because she was up there hiding out, filed divorce papers, and she was at her mother and father's place, which he was one of the 12 disciples of Satan, Leonard Millman. Child Protective Services was notified by state of Texas to check on my daughter. And they said, oh, there's nothing the matter with her. Oh, she lives in such a beautiful home. And oh, she's well taken care of. You don't have to worry about her. I mean, all they did was cover it up. They didn't even investigate or do anything about the fact that she had a warrant for her arrest out of the state of Texas. That's Child Protective Services, folks.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how bad it is.
Yeah, and for me, it is like, when it really kind of took off is when I started doing this this investigation on a facility where it's referred to as Aurora Plains Academy. And it's in Plankton, South Dakota. And when I was there, it was the initial picture I saw was a kid who looked like he was 10 years old. He was actually older than that, but he had this massive black eye. And I asked where this had been taking place. And a short while later, I began coming into contact with multiple parents who then introduced me to a Facebook group that everybody everybody was there talking about these abuses at this facility. So I kind of put it on the march where I went and started contacting these victims repeatedly over and over to try and to get their story out there. And initially I was working with a gentleman who worked for the Argus Leader, which is the Sioux Falls newspaper. And he and I were working for a year. His name was Mark Walker. And then suddenly the head of the Argus had turnover, and they hired a guy who wasn't qualified for his spot and put him at the top. And like I've always said, South Dakota only puts out like 90% of the stories out there. The last 10%, they do not touch. You won't see certain stories in the paper. And so when this story came out, like he was so infuriated with the decisions being made by the head of the Argus Leader, he pulled the plug on his career. But he at least put me in touch with the group, nonprofit group called South Dakota News Watch, and they ran the story, and it turned out to be like a 5 or 6 part series. One of the ways that the state was covering up these abuse occurrences was that they had the registered agent for the facility was the state's attorney. So any abuse allegations would end up in the state's attorney's lap and instantly be swept under the rug. So this has been going on for a decade. One of the most interesting testimonies I recall was a kid by the name of Nicholas Bertrand. And Nick's story was interesting in that, he was put in there and he hadn't been on any medication whatsoever. And suddenly they put him on 3 hard psychotropics and one other medication. And then they put him, he gave him those, and he says, I had to be physically lifted into my bunk. It's like I would never been on anything like this before, and they lifted him and put him into his bunk. And ultimately that's where it showed me, that's what they're doing to these kids as part of this whole, they're basically taking these kids, putting them in these facilities, and they have the doctors to be able to sign off, this kid needs this med, this kid needs this med. So suddenly these kids are taking a whole slew of medications that they're not even used to. And then at the time of their, when they're outplaced from the facility, if they go back on the street, suddenly all those medications are taken away. So Nick was telling me years later, he's like, I dealt with addiction issues for a long time because these guys made me an addict.
So in a nutshell, they're kidnapping, illegal kidnapping children off these Indian reservations, take them away from their parents, then they're putting them in these facilities so they can just profit off this whole thing. And then they put them into foster care, and it's just a big cycle that goes on.
Yep, and the ones that go in the facilities, they mass medicate them so that once they are released on the street, if they are out on their own, they're dealing with addiction issues. And because of the amount of money that they're taking from hijacking the kids, certainly the Native American kids, all these kids are now dealing with addiction issues on top of that, and they are the ones creating the opioid crisis, which I, like most South Dakotans, didn't find any ounce of humor when Christy Noem decided she was going to put out the public campaign where the slogan for our opioid or for the crisis we were facing was meth, I'm on it. That was the slogan for all of South Dakota, meth, I'm on it. And it appalled so many South Dakotans that was the case. And then the other thing that people later found out was that it sounded like she used a great deal of money to source an outside ad agency to do it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so she's well aware of everything that's going on and has been for some time, but so have the last some of our states are representatives, and like John Thune, Mike Rounds, Dusty Johnson, they know this is going on.
Now Thune is he's a senator, correct?
Yes.
U.S. senator.
Yep, and Mike Rounds, U.S. senator, and then Dusty Johnson is our representative.
So they all need to be voted out.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, I think in South Dakota that there's enough people that are benefiting off of their scheme that they've put together to where many of those people will never vote them out, and the others are very staunch conservatives and don't understand what's happening. And so they will always be the ones to maintain South Dakota as a red state.
Well, maybe enough people will hear this radio program and you'll get some attention from it.
Yeah, and so I just know that with so much of it, it was so intriguing to me, and we've kind of spoke about faith and everything like that. I did this whole investigation at this Aurora Plains for like 2 years, and I like when it all transpired and the stories came out, I remember being remarkably frustrated because you had Kristen Oates saying, oh, we got to get to the bottom of that, and that stalled out as soon as she said that. She has made that, like, there's been nothing more ever that came out about that facility. And so, but on the heels of that, that's how I started coming into these families that are dealing with the answers for their loved ones and not being able to get any. And so you just, it's kind of turned into that, but it was specifically from this investigation. Suddenly I had one person tied to this missing person, one person tied to this murder, and just, it just ballooned into something else that was far greater.
And the FBI, of course, won't do anything.
No, we've had situations with the FBI where one woman whose husband was killed decided to reach out to local FBI to see, and this is, and according to what I learned, that Marty Jackley knew that the FBI wouldn't help her and basically laughed in her face.
Well, I know that in Kansas City, the Joint Task Force group, they call it, it's part of the local police departments, intelligence divisions. It's part of hit teams that they hire Somalians and Kenyans, like the ones that tried to murder me in a car crash rover, and they covered it up.
Mm-hmm.
Later I proved, and it's on my website on the below breaking news, you can see a van sitting on a concrete barrier. That was my head underneath there.
Yeah, I did see that one.
Yeah, but you look at the PI report, that was after police covered it up, Grandview, Missouri, and an attorney, I went to him, and he filed a suit on that, two other car crashes where they did meet in 1 year, three car crashes. And the last one was an Iran-Contra player, J. Stevens truck driving school, Stevens Transportation hauls drugs for Daddy Bush, Iran-Contra, uh-huh. Still alive today. And I even testify without an attorney before I hired this attorney, or after the attorney was threatened, excuse me. After he got the money off that case, we paid the chiropractor $5,000 I owed him. He collected the difference after he paid the private investigator about $10,000 or $12,000. That the report's in there, if you click on that picture of the van on the concrete barrier. He wrote exactly how I said the car crash happened, because he went back out there and still marks on the concrete barrier. And of course he had all the pictures from the police and pictures from me and the whole bit. And he wrote the report, and nobody challenges him in court in Kansas City. So this attorney ended up collecting the money. Then all of a sudden he resigns, two more car crashes to collect on. He resigns. He refuses to sue Grandview, Missouri Police Department for obstruction of justice, cover-up, RICO, the whole bit. And he drops my other two cases And he's standing in Jackson County Court before the head judge there in Independence, Missouri. And I said, I want to know why he's resigning. And the judge told me that he could not force him to say why he's resigning off the case, why he withdrew.
Yeah.
He said, but take him to the Bar Association, and he said he'll have to testify there. Well, it turns out to be later, someone told me that was working for his firm, told me that I ran across in person, said that he had been threatened by the FBI, if he didn't resign. My divorce attorney in Dallas, Texas, called me up and said he's resigning off the case. And I said, why, Frank? He says, come into my office, I'll talk to you. So we set an appointment for that day, and I went in, and he's got a gun in his pocket. And he says, the reason I'm resigning, you didn't tell me your ex-father-in-law was a mob don. I said, what did you say to me, Frank? I didn't know he was any mob don. I had nothing to do with him during the time of marriage. But he told me, he said, yeah, he says, four goons. My two kids are in the back seat of the car. My wife's in the front seat. We had just gotten in the car, and they come up, knock on the doors, pull the doors open, and shove guns in everybody's head, everybody's face. And said, if you don't resign from Stu Webb's case, we're going to blow you away right now. Do you understand? He says, yes. So he resigned as my divorce attorney.
Wow.
I know. That's what they do. Then they had a hearing without me notified and terminated my parental rights. And then it was like 30 days later, I'm down there after going around trying to find an attorney. They wanted $250,000. They said they wanted $100,000, and the judge wanted $150,000, contributed to her campaign, which was legal in Texas at the time. Millman had given him $75,000. And I go in there a little over 30 days later. Oh, no, your parental rights terminated and your 30 days for appeal has passed. I said, what? So, anyway.
Yeah.
The ironic part is my daughter became a psychiatrist, MD. Isn't it kind of true that they say that sometimes the people in that field, they're trying to figure themselves out?
Oh, absolutely.
And cops become cops because they're insecure and they want a badge and gun to feel secure.
Yeah, that was never more evident than when I was working in the penitentiary. It's like one of the first, one of the kids that we had in my training class was easily one of the most ridiculed kids coming out of high school, it seemed, and he had a bone to pick. And so, yeah, I mean, very much when he arrived, it's like, I remember specifically he had, like, one inmate had him so scared that it's like, I was just like, pretty much was very, I was having to kind of pull this kid along because this inmate owned him in that moment, and because he was afraid that he was going to urinate all over him, and it's like, thankfully we found an inmate to kind of act as a buffer to where to allow him to go up and take care of this, but yeah, the kid was insecure, he was terrified.
So basically our whole judicial system is corrupt, would you say?
Yes. And it's like just in the materials that I'm finding in just a couple cases that I have, in the one they recused the original judge who was assigned to it. And so this other judge comes in, and next thing you know, the defense the public defender convinces this gentleman to go with a judge trial instead of a jury trial. And so it's like this gentleman who spoke very little English had no idea how much of a sitting duck he was from right out of the gate.
Okay, I got a question off the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think we are as far as the United States right now with the situation in the Ukraine? You're a smart guy.
Yeah, to me, everything that I've heard about Ukraine pertains to this human trafficking. And that's where I believe that that's a lot of what is going on there. And I know better than to trust like what our media is selling it as. And so, but everything I heard that Ukraine was a massive trafficking hub.
Well, I know that the K-State, Kansas University, Manhattan, that biological chemical agents were built there by our government and shipped to the Ukraine underneath Daddy Bush and his regime and others, Clinton's, etc., Obama's, and that they've got the largest biological waste dump, should we say, I call it a waste dump, underground in the world. And if Obama went off over there, the whole planet would be contaminated. I'm also aware of Rocky Flats and uranium being 2,000 pounds of plutonium, excuse me, missing, were shipped through Apex Aviation St. Louis to Israel, then to the Ukraine, to South or North Korea, bought some of it, etc. But it seems it points to Israel, where a lot of the Khazarian Jews came from, out of the Ukraine that formed the State of Israel. Now, for the edification of the listeners, I posted up a video, a rare find. Professor Joe came up with it, who does a lot of shows with me. And it's on breaking news. It says 150,000 Jews come together in a stadium there in Chicago. Now, this is in 1933, folks. 1933 videotape. Worshiping Moloch with smoke coming out of his nose, big tall statue of him, and they did a human sacrifice right there in the stadium. And the first president of Israel was present. Now that's a video everybody should look at. And there's another video that shows human sacrifice that an FBI agent gave me once that they had passed to a producer in Canada and it never got any play. And he figured I could probably get some play out of it. So I put it on YouTube and they pulled it. They said they couldn't have it, but it was a ATF or DEA bust on a drug house in California. And there's two women there and some guy just cut the head off of somebody, sacrificed them. They had blood on their face where they were drinking his blood. They had him in handcuffs on the couch. And they found a head in a box where these Satanists buy people's heads. And they were getting ready to ship it. They dug up the backyard and found, I think it was 6 additional bodies. So if you go up there on stuweb.com, and you'll have to probably cut and paste the link because they're messing with my website pretty heavy. But look at it, it's under breaking news. It's right there along with that other video. But put that in there and take a look at it. That was the actual footage from a bust at a drug house. But we've got not only body parts being shipped like Debbie Davis talked about, with John McCain out of the Arizona National Guard, but also human trafficking of children and even adults, guns, drugs, any kind of weapons at all. And he was head of Armed Services Committee. His wife, by the way, has the beer company. I forgot which one it is, Budweiser, one of them. And she had a dry cleaning plant in Afghanistan. And what they were shipping back was being shipped by Jeb Bush in drones to Missouri. Now it's being shipped to a Hollywood Air Base. It's a public base where there's a hangar down there that L. Milman, as in Leonard Milman, and N. Bush, as in Neil Bush, own the hangar. That's what's on the deed. So this is nationwide, worldwide, this is going on. And nobody's doing a damn thing about it. What do we need, a revolution?
Yeah, and to me it just seems like enough people, because when I first began exploring all this, I actually, it was with the expressed intent of bringing to light the situation regarding a child by the 17-year-old boy who was mismedicated. His name was Brady Fulkins. And so I drove to New York City with the materials that I had to, and I, we had been, me and his mother had been corresponding with a producer for ABC, ABC News, by the name of Terry Whitcraft. And so when we were in discussion with her, I made the trip out there with the materials, and the thing that still kind of mesmerizes me to this day was that when I arrived in her office, the first words out of my mouth weren't pertaining to Brady. The first words out of my mouth were, South Dakota is trafficking kids for federal dollars and they're targeting Native American kids. And while she said the Brady Fulkin story wouldn't be one there was nothing with everything being a visual medium, there wasn't much to do that she could do with that. But she later claimed that the trafficking of the Native American kids was interesting, and this was when a lot of stuff was really hot with the up in on the Standing Rock Reservation, where you had everything kind of blown up there. This was right around that time as well. So,
well, I know that Daddy Bush and Leonard Millman and Brofman, Seagram 7, bought up the media. They bought up ABC, NBC, CBS. This was all in the early 90s, around 93, I think it was. And that ended up a way that later ABC, Disney, I think it was, that was Millman, and CBS with Daddy Bush, and the other was Brofman. But they had CNN, the Cocaine News Network with Ted Turner. And Ted Turner, Jane Fonda, was married to him. And I won't get into all the discussion, but she divorced him because she found out after they had taken him over and kind of pushed him out, he had about, well, all across the northern part, Wyoming, Colorado, Dakotas, et cetera. He had big, huge tracts of land where Daddy Bush and his little shadow government was doing drug drops with airplanes and dumping them out of the airplanes. And he had those spots. Well, I had the opportunity to talk to Jane Fonda one time years ago after she divorced him for about 15 to 30 minutes, whatever it was. It was a short conversation. But I mentioned that those airstrips, and that was the reason she divorced him when she found out, because she's a born-again Christian. But
yeah,
he wasn't.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because like a couple of years ago, a colleague of mine was invited to observe a radar tower in Gettysburg, South Dakota. And what was interesting is that earlier this year, it was the entire base, which is just this one person outpost. He said that when they were able to go and like view this place, the gentleman who was at this outpost acted like he hadn't seen a human being in some time. I mean, he, I imagine he got out from time to time, but it just his social demeanor was just almost, I don't want to say like a prisoner, because it would have been his choice to be there, but at the same time, just that isolated. And so right across the river is the Missouri River is the Cheyenne River Indian Reservation, and it's been reported on several fronts to me that that there is a functioning cartel on the Cheyenne River Reservation. And so that was with the Gettysburg thing, that always kind of stood out to me, where it's like, why on earth would you have like the single man outpost with a functioning radar tower out in the middle of nowhere? And then the other one that stood out to me was when I went I learned of another Air Force base been shut down for some time. It's referred to as Camp Igloo, and it's just outside of Edgemont, South Dakota. And on this particular site is 575 survival bunkers built for basically elite clientele. And you, like, I've been on their website, and you have to go through and like fill out this application that basically kind of indicates what your line of work is and different stuff like that. And it's just this 575 survival bunkers in the middle of nowhere, South Dakota.
Now, is that?
And Go ahead. And basically, it's just just out there in the middle of nowhere. And I can't remember the asking price, but it's like 30 to 45,000 or something like that for one of these bunkers. And yeah, it's just.
I did a house. I remodeled a house in Yankton, South Dakota. You know where that's at, correct?
Yeah.
So that really is kind of the start of the Missouri River. And above that are different lakes right there. Yankton's got a big lake. I don't know how, it's about 6 miles long. And this, these lakes go all the way up through South Dakota and into North Dakota.
Yeah.
And Yankton, it was kind of strange, but Super Spook Otis Johnson, 007's the one that got me the contract with someone that owned a restaurant there in Hastings where he lived. Nebraska, and he got me the contract because the guy's neighbor, it was his aunt that lived next door to this house, so he bought it off the tax rolls, and then gave the kid who inherited the house, it was a mess, gave him $10,000. Well, I went in, spent, I think, 5 months up there, made 50 grand, and he bought all the material, and he gave me a couple cards, and I went to lumber yard every time I need something. They came up every weekend, check the work, and pay me. Pete, he's now dead, but I remodeled that house, and the realtor said, "Oh, you guys might be able to get $110,000 out." And I said, "No, it'll sell for at least $140." It did sell for $140. So he got his money out, and he was a happy camper. But that river is where they start dumping sewage. Not so much in Yankton, but the other cities on down the river that goes through Omaha and down to Kansas City. And I remember being in Kansas City in my younger years, and one summer the river was so full of crap before they put carp in there to start eating the crap out of the river that it stunk all over Kansas City for about 2 to 3 months. You could smell the river. That's how bad it was.
Yeah.
And they drink out of the water, Kansas City and Overland Park, Kansas, and which is about the 12th richest county per capita in the nation, which is right there on the border of Kansas City. They drink the water. The people are drinking this water. Now, I've talked to someone recently. They're in Virginia. They're being poisoned with the water over there. It's contaminated. They can't even drink the water. It's that bad. I mean, we got a problem, I believe, with most of the agencies in our country.
Yeah,
they're not doing their job. But anyway, is there any last words? Because I'm going to wrap the show up because we're at about an hour and 13 minutes right now.
Yep.
And I want you to give the last words. What you think people need to do, etc.
Basically, just with the stuff that's going on here, all I know is that right now, I'm working with several families whose loved ones are missing and murdered, or the whole South Dakota suicide thing. And, I know that we can't depend in any way, shape, or form on our law enforcement. I had a situation roughly 6 months ago where I learned of a circumstance where five of our county agencies all came down on a dwelling in a remote part of South Dakota. And it included SWAT, it included our local DCI, Department of Criminal Investigation, and everybody converged on this house. And the report came out, and they killed the gentleman at this house. And the reason I bring it up is because, according to the report, he got off almost 90 shots from about five separate firearms. He hit a Bearcat, which is a basically an armored vehicle, maybe dinged it. And according to their report, they fired one shot from 200 yards away, and that was what killed him. And it's like, as I've talked with several law enforcement, you're going to have so much suppression fire if he's firing shot after shot just to keep him from killing you. So there were the report of a one shot from 200 yards away is completely asinine to believe. But this report, the report of this instance, it occurred on a Saturday night going into Sunday morning. I was at this location on Monday at noon. And so you're looking at probably not even 36 hours after the event happened. And you would have had that many shots fired from the location. You would have had everything. I went by the location. There was no police presence, no police tape. There was nothing. And I fully believe this guy was murdered by law enforcement.
Let me tell you what happened to me. I'm in Las Vegas. And Ted Gunderson, I had mentioned the fact of his role in selling Stinger missiles to bin Laden. And he didn't like hearing that. And I got that from, I believe it was Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien, Transformation of America, where I was in a dinner meeting with them in Las Vegas, and Gunderson was there. And Phillips going to get more food at the buffet, and I went with him to get more food. And Gunderson's questioning Kathy because he wants to know what she's got in her new book. They're getting ready to go to California to the publisher. So he's really questioning her up. Well, then later, I bring up the fact about the Stinger missiles, and he went nuts on me. And he accused me, or didn't accuse me, but he said I took documents from him, of which I never took. And this was a troll. He was kicked out of the FBI, folks, in 1979, I think it was, for holding a satanic ceremony in his FBI office in Los Angeles. And the underlayments underneath him at the FBI reported him. They did an evaluation. I found out that he had been diagnosed in 1972 as being a paranoid schizophrenia. And his wife said he came home from work. I have her on audio tape. It's on Breaking Bar 1, or Radio Bar Number 1. Saying they came home from work, stripped down in front of his daughter and her friends, and jumped in the pool where they were swimming. So she called the kids in. And then she locked the door and she threw his clothes out the window and she divorced him. Well, he has a son, Ted Jr., and a daughter, I think her name is Lori, that are diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenia also. They don't take their meds. But Gunderson had a SWAT team come in and hit me, saying that I took documents of his. He was trying to confiscate some documents I had, and he was afraid that I had the documents on the Stinger missiles, of which I do, and they're up on the website. And punching Ted Gunderson Stinger missiles, and you see them, where he was selling them to bin Laden. But the point was, he was after those documents I had to find out what I had on him. And he had a SWAT team hit me, and it wasn't real pleasant, folks. I mean, I was in a trailer house in Las Vegas renting it, and all of a sudden the windows were being broken out everywhere, and guns were sticking through the walls, or through the windows on me. Now, the SWAT team left after the detectives and SWAT team left, found nothing. They even brought Gunderson there, who walked through the place. Oh, those are my documents. And they said, no, this got Stu Webb's name on it. These are his documents. So I just want to let that be apparent. He was a plant and a troll in the Patriot community. He infiltrated Jackie McGauley, who was the McMartin preschool case. He said he released the finder's documents. He did not. The finder's documents were released by Jim Rothstein, who I've had on the air. He was a New York cop trafficking in kids, used them to blackmail congressmen and senators with. He always tried to claim to fame something he had nothing to do with, intentionally. He was there. Matter of fact, Jackie McGaughey ended up dead, suicided, reportedly a few years back. And I still have suspicions because she and I had done a couple shows together talking about the McMartin, the California McMartin school case, where they were taking kids from that school and taking them across through a tunnel and letting pedophiles molest these children. But I just wanted to bring that up.
So, yeah, and I think just to kind of further along the lines of what you were getting at, it's just that all I know to say is that if there's a listener out there that thinks that they can help in any facet of the circumstances that I've mentioned or specific cases that kind of drew something in about them, then by all means, it's like if there's a way to connect us to where this can go further.
I'll be happy to connect them. So everybody, my phone number is right there on my website, stuweb.com. Yeah. And you can send me an email at federalwhistleblower@gmail.com. And I'll be happy to put you in touch right here with Paul. Register.
Yes, that would be fantastic. And I believe that God aligns everything for a reason. And he's made so much, he's shown me beyond what I ever would have fathomed 7 years ago. And it's just that all I know is I just know to keep going, because otherwise these circumstances will continue. You'll have innocent people murdered. You'll have children stolen unless you jump in the mix and do something.
Well, Paul, I'm the oldest living whistleblower, 38 and a half years now. And by the grace of God, it's been 40 times they tried to murder me. And it's only by the grace of God and Jesus Christ the only reason I'm breathing. And I know that. So, but that's it, folks. You know, prayer works. You
got to keep
asking for those angels of protection, where it says in Psalms 91 and 92 to ask for them, and you'll have them. But just like yourself, it's pretty obvious with what you've been through and investigated, God's keeping you alive for a reason.
Absolutely.
You got any last word?
All I know is just I really appreciate the opportunity to come on your show and discuss all this. And it's just the amount of families that I with the job that I do now, it affords me. Like, I have people telling me, it's like, well, you should become a private investigator. You should go do this for work. And it's like, I know that through the many occurrences that have happened in my favor over and over, that Romans 8:28 has been just beaten over my head for the duration of time that I've been doing this, where it says, and we know in all things, everything works to the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And I've never had so much stuff like continue to work in my favor as this has gone on. And I was explaining to the last family that I'm trying to help their situation, and I said, look, I'm not the guy who goes and shakes the tree and the fruit falls out. I'm the guy that walks under the tree and the fruit falls on him. It has happened more times than I can count, but it's led me to every point that I needed to come to continue this fight and help these families and learn what I needed to learn about this state.
That's good. And I thank you, Paul, for coming on. I want you to hold on after we close the show down here. But I want to thank you, Paul Register. And folks, you want to get in touch with him if you're in South Dakota, or you want to get in touch with him from another state, whatever, to deal with some of the problems that maybe you can exchange ideas, feel free to give me a call. With that, thank you, Paul, for being on with me.
You bet. Thanks, Stu. Appreciate it.